The name of the book is Untypical, and it's written by Pete Wormby, who joins me via Zoom. Pete, it's lovely to talk to you and great to see you as well. How are you today?
Yeah, great to see you too. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm good. I'm getting ready for tomorrow when the book comes out. Just trying to keep the nerves at bay.
Well, there you go. I'm sure it'll be absolutely fine. Now, this is described as a groundbreaking book on what steps we should be taking for the autistic people in our lives. And I've kind of read the little brief earlier on when I was talking about who was coming on the program. And I mentioned that you've said that this, it was exhausting to fit into a world not designed for you. So obviously you had an autism diagnosis, but it didn't come soon enough for you, maybe?
No, indeed. It was, I was 34 when that finally came. So yeah, it was missed in the 90s, you know, when I was at school, and throughout, you know, the majority of my life. And so it was about six, I turned 40 a couple of weeks ago. So it's been 6 years since I found out. And yeah, it's been quite an interesting ride getting adjusted to that new sense of who I am and how I work.
And I suppose having a label.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, having it's interesting. You know, when you gain a label like that, it can feel quite disorientating. But it also means that you find a community, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
you know, you find people who also have that label. You know, and so for the first time, I felt a kind of sense of being amongst others who understood. You know, particularly online, autistic people do tend to congregate online.
Really?
Because it's a bit easier. We do, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. There's various parts of communication that's quite difficult for autistic people. Things like eye contact, facial expressions, things like that. So talking online to each other, you know, just chatting away in chat boxes or on Twitter or whatever, it just kind of helps. It works for us.
Okay. Let me ask you a question that might be a very obvious question to you, but I'm going to ask it. Are there different degrees of autism? Are there different levels?
There are. The people have lots of different terminology for this. One of the more famous in the UK, at least, is the idea of high functioning versus low functioning. Which is an interesting one, because though it, you know, obviously it suggests that some autistic people can get by quite easily, you know, and manage lives, whereas other autistic people might struggle. It does tend to ignore the fact that for many of us, our kind of functioning level fluctuates considerably, you know, depending on what's going on. But yes, certainly there are people for whom being autistic is perhaps more of a disability, you know, causes more issues for them on a daily basis, whereas there are others who may, you know, even to the point where they don't even consider it to be a disability because they manage it well, you know, and that's very different for everybody. Often also autism can kind of coexist with other conditions. So things like, you know, for example, learning disabilities or ADHD or very frequently depression and anxiety. And of course, that has a big impact too, you know, on how the world will, how easily you'll be able to negotiate through the world.
I was going to ask you actually how easy or difficult it is to live with autism. And I was, the reason I was going to ask that was because there can often be inverted commas funny side to autism. And I'm thinking about the character Sheldon in what do they call that program?
And Big Bang Theory.
Big Bang Theory, that's it, right? And there's always, you know, he's always learning something, learning what might be sarcasm, learning what, you know, might constitute an actual conversation or whatever the case might be. You describe it as being draining or being, you know, really kind of sapping your energy. Can I ask you how that manifested itself insofar as for 34 years you didn't know that you were autistic, and then obviously there was a series of events or just a culmination of the exhausting efforts that had to go. Will you talk us through that period, please?
Yeah, of course. It's actually really interesting. Most autistic people, not all, I always have to say not all, because we're so varied. But most of us, at least, will undergo something that we call autistic masking, which is it's like a defense mechanism, I suppose, that we sort of learn subconsciously just over time. And what it consists of is autistic people learning the behavior that non-autistic people do. You know, so for example, how non-autistic people communicate, how they use body language, how they get through the day. And we kind of watch it and we learn it and we try to use it ourselves in order to avoid being noticed as being different. Because, of course, you know, as I think everyone knows, that being different is usually something that can lead to bullying and, you know, bad treatment and that kind of thing. So as a defense mechanism, we mask, you know, we put on these masks to try not to be noticed. The trouble, I mean, that would be fantastic if it was easy.
Yeah.
You know, if it was energy free, you know, then that'd be great, you know, but sadly it's not. You know, it's incredibly draining. I mean, I suppose the analogy would be anyone who might lack confidence or be a bit of an introvert, you know, even if they're not autistic, they might put on a bit of a mask if they're going to a party or doing an interview, you know, and they'll try to appear more gregarious than they ordinarily are, you know, in order to get by. And I think nearly everyone will know that once you leave that situation, you're exhausted. You know, you just kind of go, oh God, that was hard. You know, now I can relax again. And it's like that all the time for autistic people, whenever we're, you know, in public around non-autistic people.
Based on that, let me ask you a question and an honest answer, please. This interview or this conversation, I never like to say interview, this conversation, was this something that you had to prepare for?
Well, it's an interesting combo because first of all, I am masking. That's very definitely the case. You know, I'm trying to make eye contact. You know, we're over Zoom, so it's a bit different. But I'm being more confident and more outgoing than I naturally am. Okay. You know, that's fine. But yeah, in terms of preparation, though, I'm also ADHD, or at least I think I am. Okay. I'm on a waiting list. You know, the NHS is struggling a little bit. So as an ADHD person, I don't tend to prepare much.
Okay.
I tend to just, you know, go for it and just hope for the best, which seems to work. But emotional preparation, I think, I did have to do. You know, before I do anything like this, I have to kind of get my head straight and just kind of think, you know, it'll be okay, it'll go fine. You know, there's an anxiety there. Yeah. You know, always.
Well, I remember doing an interview with a lady in this very studio, in fact, and it was over Zoom, and I think she was kind of keyed up about it in advance. Anyway, it all went really, really well. And when the conversation finished on air, I put on an ad break or I put on a song or whatever the case might be. And then I went to what we call pre-fade listen, so you can talk to people off air. And I just said, let's call her Mary. I said, Mary, I hope that was okay for you. And she said, oh, yes, that was lovely. That was great. I said, well, thanks very much. I said, goodbye now and we'll chat again. And before I had actually turned off the Zoom, she said to whoever was in the room, she said, Jesus, that was terrible. That was awful. I was hoping that she didn't mean that I was awful, but such it was a bad experience. I don't know what it was, but she obviously was keyed up about it beforehand. Listen,
yes.
Let's talk about the book, because it says the title is Untypical, How the World Isn't Built for Autistic People and What We Should Do, or We Should All Do About It. So, why and how is the world not built for autistic people, firstly? And then tell me what we can do.
I'll do my best. I mean, the analogy that I've come to using a little bit for this idea of the world not being built is to use another one of my attributes, if you like, which is that I'm actually very, very tall. I mean, you can't tell, but I'm 6'7", so I'm at that kind of extreme end of height. Right. And as you can probably imagine, when you're that big, the world isn't built for you either. You know, doorways and, you know, low ceilings, and I get a bad back from doing the washing up and ironing because everything's lower than I need it to be. So I think that's a nice way of looking at it in a physical way. You know, it's the world just, you know, the world is designed for the average. You know, the world is designed for the majority. And autistic people, or even wider neurodivergent people, so autistic, ADHD, dyslexic, Tourette's, all those kind of ways of being, we're the minority. fairly comfortably. So everything really that exists in the world, from the ways that we communicate to the brightness of lights and the use of ambient music in supermarkets and the shininess of everything, is designed for, I suppose, what you could call the neuro majority, just the non-autistic majority. So if you've got autistic people who, for example, are often very much, very much struggle with bright lights or loud noises or endless sounds or strong smells, then we kind of just sort of huddle through life dealing with all of the sensory stuff that's designed for non-autistic people that causes us tremendous stress and pain and anxiety. The non-autistic people around us don't even know. They don't know that we're going through that. They're not doing it on purpose. They don't wake up every morning and say, right, I'm really going to upset some autistic people today. I'm going to go and leave my engine running on the street and just see how many autistics I wind up. That's not how it goes. It's just people living their lives without knowing that we're all around, kind of hands over our ears, sunglasses on, trying to cope. So it's just an accidental thing. The world just doesn't fit for us. And often it's just simple little tweaks, little bits and bobs that people or organizations can do that make a big difference. I mean, I don't know how things are there, but certainly in the UK and Ireland as well, there's increasing attempts to have things like autistic-friendly hour in supermarkets or museums, where they just sort of dim the lights a little and maybe turn the music off, and it's a bit quieter, there's less people at that time. And it's such a great start. I mean, it's not everything, but it's such a good start, just to be aware, just to acknowledge that we have that sensory difficulty, and that, going into Tesco's with the ambient music turned off and with the lights dimmed just a fraction is a slightly easier experience, that makes us less likely to, get migraines or get really stressed or be really unhappy.
How do you function then when you go to your local supermarket and there is music, or you go to a restaurant? I'm one of these people that I can have music on in the background forever, right? Mm. But suddenly I can't take shouting and roaring in a song. Mm. Okay, like Adele now, for instance, shouts and roars and I just turn the radio off. right. And I'm guessing that it's kind of like that. I remember I was driving only a couple of, maybe 2 weeks ago, in the car, and my partner was with me, and the radio was on. And the next thing it dawned on me, it's the radio that's annoying me. And I turned it off, and I said, that's awful. And she said to me, I was wondering how long it would take. She said, it survived long enough. She knows what the triggers for me would be, Yeah. So I can only imagine for somebody that would be autistic that it must be a very difficult scenario.
It is. And it's funny you mention the radio, because that's the analogy I always use when I do, talks and go into businesses and, kind of share experience. Because I always use the analogy of, when you're trying to parallel park, outside someone's house, you're stressed and it's difficult and there's a car waiting, you're just all a bit het up and the radio's playing. And I always say to the people that, listening or the audience or whoever, what's the first thing you do, when the radio's playing and you're about to parallel park? And everyone always says, well, I turn the radio off. Of course you do. You don't need that extra data. You don't need that extra input. It's just for us autistic folk, we can't turn it off. we can't just turn the knob off. For example, one aspect of my being autistic is that I can't filter anything, any sound or sight. I joked in the book that when I walk down the street, my brain files very carefully and diligently every single number plate on every single car that I pass. I'm not saying I remember them necessarily, but I can tell it's taking them in. It's just endless data collection. I don't need sound, visual, everything. So that can be a bit bit much, as you can probably imagine. You know, that's quite a stressful way to be. So, I always, use this analogy, you turn the radio off, and because that's what you need to do, is sensory overload. And that's how we exist. So yeah, when I go to a supermarket, which to be fair, thanks to COVID, I haven't had to do much because we got so used to the delivery, so I don't have to go to the supermarket anymore. But when I used to, there was always a reasonable chance that I would kind of snap, and just have to leave. It's what we call it's what a lot of people call autistic meltdown or shutdown, where our limit of stress is reached. Just like it is for anyone. I mean, every human being has this. You know, you reach your limit and you can't go on. It's just because we're always quite close to that limit, happens a bit more often, it was a kind of 50-50 toss-up whether I would actually manage to make it through the supermarket or not without just having to leave and, go and calm down outside,
In terms of the book, is it for people without autism to understand it and yourselves more, or is it for people with autism to maybe understand themselves, or both, or what?
I'd say both. Okay. I went for both, certainly. That was my target. Ever since I was diagnosed and I started talking about it openly, online and elsewhere, a lot of people always say, it's good to read something so relatable, something that I recognize in myself. I do want to do that, maybe it reassures some autistic people that, their experience is shared by at least one other person, but also, very much a kind of call to the non-autistic majority that, we're here. This is kind of how many of us work, so please be aware of that. And maybe, if you do know about this stuff a bit more, then maybe you'll be a bit more patient with us, or a bit more compassionate, a bit more reasonable, and not push us too hard, which is how we tend to experience life.
Have you any idea the percentage of population, maybe in the UK and maybe across Ireland, or maybe you have a figure for Europe, that will be autistic?
It's really up in the air. Okay. It used to be held for quite a long time as a kind of very nice round number of 1 in 100. So I suppose 1%. But that's kind of outdated now. And certainly the most recent research I read was highlighting, I think it was around 1 in 30. But it might be considerably more than that, maybe even edging up towards 1 in 20. I find 1 in 30 quite useful because I used to be a teacher. And 1 in 30 kind of suggests one person in every classroom, so that's the way things are going. And it's a result, I think, primarily of us just being more aware now of what autism actually is. So we're getting better at diagnosing it. I doubt very much that the number of autistic people has actually changed much in terms of, the rate of autism in a population. I think it's far more likely we're just better now at identifying it and saying, your brain is different and for these reasons. So we're getting closer now to the true rate of what autism really is in the population.
A flippant question, firstly, and then a serious question. The flippant question being, what possessed you to become a teacher if you are sensitive to noise and distractions? What happened?
I tend to fall into things. I'm quite a passive person. I mean, even this book was kind of handed to me slightly. I didn't kind of, go chasing it, aggressively, like I guess other writers do. I was tweeting away and HarperCollins were like, oh, would you like to write a book? And I said, yeah, okay. And the thing is, my dad was a teacher, he's retired now, but he was an English teacher, it's very much like the Jedi, like my father before me, I was in a job that I found really stressful, and I noticed that, that there was a shortage of English teachers, and my dad had done it, so I knew something about it, and so I just kind of thought, okay, well, I'll try that. And no, to be honest, you're completely right, it was not a wise career move. I it was very stressful. I never found it easy. The sensory aspect was always too much, but because I didn't know what was going on, I just blamed myself and just assumed I was being flaky, and kind of just not coping. And I pushed myself way too hard, it's interesting how that kind of panned out. Needless to say, I'm not anymore. I lasted a year or so after diagnosis before I just thought, I don't need this anymore.
Let me ask you the serious question that I was going to ask then, based on the fact that you were a teacher, albeit for a short period. Did you identify anybody in your classes that you felt, yeah, you are the same as me?
I did. I mean, it's a dangerous thing to, you know, diagnose people. I mean, what was it that happened recently? Prince Harry got like diagnosed with ADHD live on air by that doctor, you know, and that's a risky
That explains
business,
everything,
you know?
Then. That explains everything.
it's a tricky thing. Right. But yeah, as a teacher, actually, you are in a unique spot, you know, to notice these things. And very often a diagnosis for a student or a child may well start with a knowledgeable teacher, you know, a clued up teacher kind of spotting a few traits and thinking, there's possibilities here. And actually, you know, you kind of want that. You know, you want the teachers to be on the ball and to spot this stuff. But yeah, I certainly did. You know, there are some students who weren't diagnosed who I thought, yeah, you know, that seemed like a plausibility, you know, if not autism, then possibly ADHD. Because once you know that of yourself and you recognize the traits and the way the behaviors and things like that, you start to notice it in others, you know, to the point now where when I went to a conference in Edinburgh just the last few days, and I was, you know, kind of figuring out whether the person I was talking to was one of the autistic delegates or one of the non-autistic delegates. Okay. You know, and I was just kind of, you know, you just kind of start vibing with them, you know, and just kind of think, yeah, you're one of us, you know,
I there was a question on the top of my tongue when you went on to the conference there. In terms of managing autism, is there such a thing? Is there medication that you can take that would help? Or because when you talk about ADHD, we know that medicine, drugs is a go-to. But what about autism then?
No, not so much. Certainly not in the same way as ADHD by any stretch. I think a lot of autistic people may well find themselves on anti-anxiety medication or antidepressants. You know, I myself am, for example. That's quite common because, as you can probably imagine from everything that I've said so far, you know, being different in this world, you know, it can lead to those two mental health kind of destinations quite easily, unfortunately. So that's a kind of medication that we're frequently very familiar with. But in terms of autistic, being autistic, no, there isn't really anything. And it's something that the autistic community is very, very much against, actually. You know, we tend as a collective, I mean, not all of us by any stretch, but as a group generally, we tend to be quite suspicious of things like that, you know, and the talk of cures, you know, because as far as we see it, you know, it's very much part of how many of us view ourselves. You know, I mean, if I wasn't autistic, I wouldn't be me. You know, it's a big part of who I am. And it might have difficulties and it might cause me stress and pain sometimes. But, you know, people have asked me in the past, you know, if you could get rid of it somehow magically, would you? And most of the time, I would definitely say no. You know, I enjoy what it brings to the table. There are positives. My first book was all about the positives that came out last year. That's all about autistic special interests, you know, our passions and our single-minded focus on things, which is joyful often, you know, just a real source of passion and joy and happiness and calm and often quite big achievements too, you know. There's all that positive stuff that I wouldn't want to lose, you know, I really wouldn't. And if the world could just adapt itself a tiny bit, I know it sounds egotistical, but if it could just adapt itself a tiny bit to make it a bit easier for me and my autistic kin, if you like, then that would be the best thing. However, you know, I do want to make clear there are some autistic people who obviously have a horrible time and probably would jump at the chance. You know, it's, as I say, we're a varied group of individuals, you know.
It goes with the territory, I suppose. Listen, it's been fascinating talking to you. I could chat to you for much, much longer, but the clock is against me and I have commercials to do and all of that kind of stuff. The name of the book is Untypical: How the World Is Not Built for Autistic People and What We Should All Do About It. Pete Warmby, thank you so much for sharing all that. I hope that I'll get this machine turned off before you say, geez, that was horrible. that you actually enjoyed it and that you're not too exhausted from it. And tomorrow is the big day for the launch. I hope that everything goes really well for you. And our listeners will be able to get that book on our website, tre.radio, because we have a virtual bookstore there, and it'll take pride of place, and they can get their hands on it. All right.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much. No, it's been a pleasure. It really has. I've enjoyed it.
Great. So have I. A joy to talk to you. Good luck tomorrow, and good luck with the ADHD diagnosis as well. Fingers crossed for that. All right. Thanks a million, Pete.